Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. We've heard of Alice Waters, Michael Pollan, and Ruth Reichel, but before them came Clementine Paddleford. The original local vor, Paddleford paved the way for millions of cooks, both at home and professionally, as she made her way across the nation and back again, chronicling what and where she ate. And she compiled it into a massive cookbook entitled How America Eats. Now, over 50 years later, a revised and updated edition has been done called The Great American Cookbook, and the editor, Kelly Alexander, tells us about the updated recipes and Clementine Paddleford.
I heard about Clementine Paddleford, who was the food editor at the New York Herald Tribune newspaper in the 50s and 60s, about 10 years ago when I happened upon a dusty old copy of her book, How America Eats. And when I opened it, I was shocked I hadn't heard of her. I was a serious student of food history. I was a food writer, and I didn't know who she was. So I had the same experience myself.
Nowadays, it seems natural to be local vores, and we think nothing of calling our dishes regional cuisine. But as Paddleford was creating How America Eats, she was pushing the boundaries on what was considered American.
Absolutely, and you are hitting on the point that really got my attention first. I'm looking at this book that is organized by state, who has a writer who said she's visited all of the states by camelback, by plane, by train. And I was amazed because what I thought was, you know, regional American food are such buzzwords now. You can't turn on the Food Network without seeing a program about regional American food. And here was a woman who'd been documenting it, you know, starting in 1948. And it was some of the same things that we still see today. It was just before the Food Network, before blogging, before any of that, you know. And it's useful to remember when we talk about food that at the very beginning, before it was possible to buy tomatoes year-round in a grocery store, we were all locavores because we had to be.
And as much as a cookbook, this is really a foodie's travelogue. I mean, she tells us stories about where and how the food was served and about the people who made it.
Her particular genius, Clementine's great triumph, was that she was coming up in an era when recipes and food sections of newspapers were dominated by home economists. So what you find was merely a formula and nothing else. But Clementine was a journalist. She'd gone to journalism school at Kansas State University. She was from Kansas. And she really believed that the stories behind the recipes were more interesting. So she started writing, along with every recipe, a little story about the person who created it. And her columns were wildly popular for it because they had this great travelogue-like quality. In fact, in her prime, she had millions of readers, and she was more popular with male readers than with women readers because her pieces have this great vicarious experience. You may never have had the chance in 1950 to go to the Florida Keys to taste key lime pie, for instance, but she's going to describe it to you and what it looked like and the people who made it, and that made it well beyond the formula.
And women were also taking a new role in society during that time, and you call Clementine the collective mom.
Right. So when Clementine was first sort of coming up, we're talking about, you know, her own career, which started really in the 1930s. Women were just moving off the farm for the first time. They were just moving into these newly industrializing American cities and leaving behind their moms, leaving behind their recipes. They were living in big cities. They didn't have anybody to hand down recipes to them, and they had to figure it out for themselves. And she knew this firsthand because that had been her experience. So what she decided to do was sort of become that kind of collective mom, to collect all of these recipes for everyone and to share them. And it was really remarkable the way she did it because, as I say, she didn't have the internet to do it. She had a newspaper. So what she would do is travel around the country and visit with real people in their real homes. That always amazes me because I imagine what it would be like if a newspaper reporter washed up on my front door and said, "Can I see how you make your apple pie?" But people did it and they loved it and it became great fun.
It sounds a lot like the WPA.
Yes, yes. This work has a lot in common with that.
Now, this is a revised edition of her classic cookbook, How America Eats. How did you go about essentially kind of updating it, but keeping the feel of Clementine?
The short answer is really carefully, because I think Clementine's voice is wonderful. A lot of food reporters write these days using the first person, and they really relay in a way that's a lot like a memoir, their first experiences with a certain food or learning to make a certain dish. And what was great about Clementine to me is that she's got this great breezy style, and she's a reporter, so she hardly ever writes about herself. She writes about the cook. And I wanted to keep the spirit of her voice in those pages and her essays as much as possible. So those weren't touched. Where we ran into a bit of a hard time is with some of the recipes. So we had more than 900 to start with, and we culled them down to 500. And that was a tricky process. In every case, we wanted to keep the spirit of the recipe the same as what Clementine intended. And we had the great advantage of these were recipes that were professionally tested once before. Before they appeared in the New York Herald Tribune, that newspaper had a test kitchen. And so all of these recipes had actually been perfected one other time. The problem is that you're dealing with recipes that were quite old. You wouldn't have had to tell a woman in 1949 who was making a pot roast in the oven to preheat the oven. That's somebody who would have had a lot of cooking experience, who would have known how to do that. We write our recipes now for people who have somehow forgotten those things, and we write them with aching specificity. So that's one of my prime jobs, was actually to make sure the directions were clear enough that a modern cook could follow. Another one of the things we discovered is that Clementine was an inveterate sweet tooth. So I easily had 50% of the recipes that were cakes and pies, just because that's what she liked the best. And so I had to sort of make it, I wanted recipes to be more reflective of other things besides sweets. And I also noticed that the sweets were really small compared to what we eat today, for better or for worse. Like a layer cake in one of Clementine's books would be designed to serve 12 people. Well, a modern person would look at that and say, there's no way now. They would have been very, very small pieces. So those are the kind of adjustments that I made along the way.
You said Clementine had a sweet tooth. I mean, just flipping through the recipes, there are just so many cake and pie recipes. I mean, there's a wet and a dry shoe fly pie.
Right.
I had no idea.
There were originally 5 shoe fly pies, so we narrowed it down to 2. And that's precisely it. You know, as a food writer, people ask me those questions all the time. Is there anything I won't eat? Is there anything I would never touch? And the answer is no. I'm game to try anything. But I do have my own personal taste buds and personal likes and dislikes. And those things always find a way to creep their way into the work. A great example in this book is that it's organized by state and by region, except there's one huge breakout chapter called Florida. And that's because Clementine grew up on a farm in Kansas. When she got to Florida, she thought it was the most exotic and beautiful place she'd ever seen. She fell in love with the orange groves. She fell in love with the weather. She went there during her career as much as she could. She devoted more columns to Florida than any other state because she found it so magical.
I would like to get to some of the recipes, and as you said, they are divided by state. And I have to start with dessert first because the mock cherry pie, just, it floored me because I was thinking, well, I wonder what a mock cherry is. And then it just seems like the perfect way to end any New England meal.
Exactly. So the title is what got you there?
Yes.
That's really funny. A mock cherry pie was something that's actually really historic. It's one of those sort of chef cheats that chefs around the country in the 50s would have used, especially because they didn't have nearly as many ingredients as we did all the time. Like, for example, you know, nowadays you can buy a tomato in the grocery store in any season. You could buy a cherry almost, but not quite. In those days, no way. When the season was over, it was over. So what a canny chef could do is use cranberries and raisins instead in combination to create the flavor of a tart cherry pie without an actual tart cherry. And it's a really fun, really, really distinctive New England recipe because it's loaded with fresh cranberries.
I have to try it. I think I'm going to tell my mom I'll do the pie this year.
You know, it's really good because the cranberries are very nice and tart and the raisins are very sweet. And somewhere in there, there's a combination as they come together that suggests cherry.
That's so odd, but so, mystifying.
You can see exactly where it comes from. These cooks in New England who are hungering for a cherry pie when it was really cold, when they might have gotten cherries 3 weeks of the year and working backwards. Well, how could we do it? Well, we could take our super tart cranberries and we could temper them with raisins. Right?
Right. Well, you know, for my family, when we get together, we carefully plan out meals for the entire time we're together. And I can think of nothing better than waking up and having the Philadelphia cinnamon buns on a cool morning and with a steaming cup of tea. And I like how Clementine writes, you know, like most recipes, some ingredients are subjective and what defines the true Philadelphia cinnamon bun may be different to different chefs.
Yeah, the nice thing about these recipes is that really they're blueprints. they're written in such a way that if you like your cinnamon buns to be really, really aromatic and vanilla-y, you can do that. If you want them to only have cinnamon in them, you can do that too. But I will tell you, that's one of my actual favorite recipes in the book. The dough is beautiful. The buns really swell up. They're giant. They're oozy. It's a really fun thing to make, and it's deceptively easy for something that turns out so beautiful. But what I like about these recipes is that there's room to interpret yourself. You can follow the technique as written and have beautiful sticky buns, and then you get to put your own twist on it. You can add orange zest or lemon zest or whatever it is that you really like, because these recipes are designed to be general. They're designed to be personalized. They weren't personalized for you.
That's like the story and the one section of D.C., it's full of recipes like the Senate salad or the congressional apple pie. But then there's an interesting story on how black beans, Cuban style, made it into that section.
Right. The Senate black bean soup was for the time a seminal American recipe that I'm not sure how many Americans today even know that there's a dining room in the Senate. And the fact that this recipe has been served there for decades upon decades, and why it's there. So it's a fun piece of history. And the D.C. section is actually another of my favorite recipes that I looked at on site and thought, oh, we'll never do this, called Casserole of Baked Crab Imperial. And part of the reason why I blanched is because casserole is such an unsexy term. It's so unmodern. But that is the most delicious lunch dish. It's really light. The crab really comes through. I mean, it's gently baked crab. We really actually debated about whether changing the title or not would be a good idea if it might turn people off. But it's lovely, and it would be great with a green salad, and that's a total D.C. thing.
Casserole, you're so right about that word.
Automatically you hear it, and you're like, oh, you imagine the worst kind of cream of mushroom soup concoction. But it doesn't have to be that way. A casserole can actually be really hot and bubbly and warming and not loaded with those sorts of things at all, especially if you have some nice crab meat. I mean, I think the key is to not overcook it. And yes, maybe you should call it something else, a gratin.
There you go. And there's a recipe for one of my most favorite dishes in the world, and that's the Welsh rabbit. And there's no rabbit, but it's cheese, beer, and cayenne pepper, and it's just so perfect on a cool day, too.
Oh, yeah, ladled over a nice piece of toast. That's delicious. But it's one of those things, too, that I'm afraid have fallen by the wayside. Do you know, I'm not sure how many modern cooks know what a Welsh rabbit is unless they had it when they were kids, and it might evoke those memories. And that's such an easy thing to make. It's just a hearty cheese sauce. It's really fondue on toast, right?
Right. And one of the interesting things about most, if not all, of these recipes, I mean, during that time, there were a lot of canned ingredients.
Yep.
But not really in these recipes.
Any time that there were canned things that we could easily substitute with fresh, it makes such a big difference that we did, because those are things that they just wouldn't have had then. I feel like if Clementine Paddleford had known her readers and had access to more fresh food, they would have been represented, because anytime she could, she did call for fresh ingredients. The problem that she faced is that supermarkets now were not what they were then. You know, there was one kind of lettuce, and it was iceberg. Forget about arugula. It was a shame because we actually had to get rid of a recipe that was really great for a barbecued pork, really traditional barbecued pork from North Carolina, vinegar-based, and it was delicious. The problem was that the original recipe called for pork tenderloin, and I wondered about that, because that's not a cut at all that we would ever use in pork. This is a tender cut that doesn't need a lot of long cooking, and pork cooks slow and low. And the reason why she called for it, we ultimately figured out, is because that was one of the only cuts that was universally available in supermarkets across the country. So if she wanted her readers to experience it, those are the kind of compromises she would have to make. And we don't have to make those kind of compromises today. We can use a nice big pork shoulder like somebody in North Carolina would.
Right. Oh, that's so interesting. And never would occur to me how she would tweak the recipes to make it more accessible.
Oh, yeah, especially when very hard-to-find ingredients would come in to the test kitchen at the Herald Tribune. That was their sort of big problem, was how can we make this so that everyone can do it? And those canned things were everywhere. Anybody had access to them. They were very new and exciting. And I think Clementine was very ambivalent about them. Cooks loved them at first because they made the idea of dinner so much faster. It took a while before people realized that they weren't very healthy for us.
Right. One of the nicest things about this book is how America is a melting pot, and she has collected recipes from sauerbraten to huevos rancheros.
Yeah, and it would have been the first time that a lot of people across the country had heard of those things. The first newspaper recipe that was ever published in a newspaper for guacamole is in this book. And that's amazing when you think about how ubiquitous guacamole is today. That somebody in not so far back, in 1955, would never have heard of it. That would have been the first time that they'd be seeing it. And she calls it guacamole salad. I think to make it sound more approachable and easy.
Well, this is an amazing book. The name of it is The Great American Cookbook, 500 Time-Tested Recipes, Favorite Foods from Every State. Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Again, it's The Great American Cookbook, edited by Kelly Alexander. It is published by Rizzoli. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.